This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. While U.S. President Trump prepares to announce new sanctions on Iran, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is planning strategy with allies in the Middle East. Pompeo discussed this with reporters as he boarded a plane just outside of Washington, D.C.
Our first stops will be in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, two great allies in the challenge that Iran presents, and we'll be talking with them about how to make sure that we are all strategically aligned and how we can build out a global coalition, a coalition not only throughout the Gulf states, but in Asia and in Europe that understands this challenge as it is prepared to push back against the world's largest state sponsor of terror.
And President Trump said on NBC's Meet the Press that he is not looking for war with Iran and he is willing to negotiate with its leaders without preconditions, but that under no circumstances can the Islamic Republic be allowed to mass a nuclear weapons arsenal. VOA's Michael Bowman has more on the rising tensions.
The Trump administration continues to put Iran on notice. President Trump has hinted that a military strike against Iranian targets still could go forward.
We have plenty of time.
While his national security advisor has warned Tehran against mistaking U.S. prudence for weakness.
No one has granted them a hunting license in the Middle East. As President Trump said on Friday, our military is rebuilt, new, and ready to go. By far the best in the world.
Amid the saber rattling, an expression of concern from a former U.S. military chief.
That is VOA's Michael Bowman reporting. Members of Sudan's protest movement say that they have accepted an Ethiopian roadmap for a civilian-led transitional government after a months-long standoff with the country's military rulers. This is VOA News. President Trump is pushing back by a couple of weeks the raids planned on Sunday by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, AP's Ben Thomas.
The operation was expected to begin Sunday and would have targeted people with final orders of removal, including families whose immigration cases had been fast-tracked by judges. But Saturday afternoon, President Trump tweeted from Camp David that he was delaying the sweep for 2 weeks at the request of Democrats. He says he hopes that will give lawmakers time to work out solutions to the border issues, which he identified as the asylum and loophole problems. In her own tweet, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says time is needed for comprehensive immigration reform, and the delay is welcome. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The ruling party candidate in the rerun of Istanbul's mayoral election has conceded defeat to opposition candidate Ekrem İmamoğlu. Sunday's vote was held because election authorities annulled the initial historic election victory in March on a technicality after President Recep Tayyip Erdogan disputed the defeat of his candidate. Electoral authorities rejected the ruling party's claims of voting fraud, but ordered a revote after a ruling a number of election officials were ineligible. According to North Korean state media, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has received a personal letter from U.S. President Donald Trump, and he's contemplating its contents. The official Korean Central News Agency posted a picture of Kim holding a letter, apparently on White House letterhead. The report quoted Kim as praising its excellent content. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Sunday confirmed the letter was sent and said he is hopeful that this will provide a good foundation for the U.S. to begin and to continue important discussions with Koreans to denuclearize the peninsula. President Trump earlier this month said he received a beautiful, very personal, and very warm letter from the North Korean leader. Though nuclear talks between U.S. and North Korean officials are stalled, Kim and Trump have been exchanging letters and pictures for the past year, and both men say their relationship remains warm. Mauritania's ruling party candidate has won an absolute majority of votes in the country's presidential election. That's according to the Electoral Commission on Sunday. The UPR candidate and former defense minister won 51.1% of the vote, according to data published on the National Electoral Commission website. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, June the 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. Ethiopian officials say that the chief of staff of the army was shot and killed by his bodyguard late Saturday, hours after what officials described as an attempted coup in Ethiopia's Amhara state. Spokeswoman for Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said Chief Sierre Makonnen and the retired general were killed in a coordinated attack in Sierre's home.
He was one of Prime Minister Abiy's recruits, and Prime Minister Abiy will really have to focus on rebounding for this, because both him and General Sierre Makonnen will be very, very difficult to replace.
Zacharias Zelelam is an Ethiopian political analyst. The East African Legislative Assembly is expected to adopt a law to cut down on corruption in its regional institutions. This comes after an audit report revealed that senior officials were involved in mismanagement of community funds.
This is one of the tools we are going to use to check the very high appetites at times we have in our institutions of ESC for officers who handle public resources.
It's Ugandan lawmaker Matias Kasamba and Sudan's ruling military council is asking that Ethiopia and the African Union combine their efforts to mediate between the council and an opposition coalition on the structure of the country's transitional government. We'll have those stories, plus how is Uganda containing the Ebola outbreak in the western district of Kasese, and some sports updates. A busy week ahead in African soccer, right here on Daybreak Africa. And we start off in Sudan, where the ruling military council is asking Ethiopia and the African Union to combine their efforts as they work to mediate between the council and the opposition coalition on the structure of the country's transitional government. The generals and the opposition coalition have been wrangling for weeks over what form Sudan's transitional government should take after the military deposed longtime President Omar el-Bashir. Both Ethiopian Prime Minister and the African Union have been trying to mediate between the sides. The council spokesman, Lieutenant General Shams el-Din Kabash, said on Sunday that the council had rejected Ethiopia's proposal, but that it had agreed in principle to the African Union's plan. Ethiopian officials said that the chief of staff of the army was shot and killed by his bodyguard last Saturday, hours after what officials described as an attempted coup in Ethiopia's Amhara state. A spokeswoman for Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said that Army Chief Sierre Makonnen and a retired general were killed in a coordinated attack in General Sierre's home. Officials say that Amhara State President Ambachew Mekonnen and his advisor were shot dead in the regional capital of Bahir Dar on Saturday evening. The Prime Minister's office named the person behind the foiled coup as Amhara State Security Head General Asmenau Tsige. Internet access in much of the country was shut down following the weekend events. As more information continues to unfold on this issue, there are still many more questions to be answered. And for that, I've reached Zelelam Zacharias, an Ethiopian journalist and political analyst based in Montreal, Canada. I asked Mr. Zelelam to provide us with some context on Saturday's events, some of the people involved, and what this attempted coup means in the country's politics.
The government has pointed its fingers at a member of the Amhara regional security apparatus, an individual known as Brigadier General Asmenau Tsige. He has a background in the Ethiopian military and was actually detained for around 9 years for similar charges, an attempted coup in 2009 by the previous administration. So he was brought in. The government bringing him in was supposed to be part of reconciliatory measures. Well, the chief of staff, which we will now have to refer to as the late chief of staff, as his death has been confirmed. General Sierre Makonnen was among the new guard of Ethiopian security apparatus officials. Last year, when the new prime minister, Abiy Ahmed, came to power, he oversaw a cleaning out of many military and intelligence officials, most of whom were dismissed. Many others have been arrested and charged with human rights abuses and murder. And General Sa'ara was among the new faces to thrive in the sort of vacuum of sorts and attempt to freshen up the security apparatus without the baggage of those from the previous administration.
From the former regime.
He was attempting to start things anew and break away, you can say, from the security apparatus that was appointed during the era of Prime Minister Melih Zenawi, former Prime Minister Melih Zenawi. Many considered him one of the main players during the reform era, and his death for them would be a serious critical blow.
And what can you tell us about Dr. Ambachew Mekonnen, the Amhara Regional State President who was killed in this attempted coup?
Okay, Dr. Ambachew Mekonnen is similarly, like General Saara, similarly seen as a member of one of the reform agents, one of the new breed of politicians that came in the post-TPLF era as a result of the demise of the previous administration. So he also had a strong section of the Amhara constituency backing him, and was a very, very vocal proponent for the Amhara people's rights and for preventing a return to the previous era of authoritarianism. So similarly, he was one of Prime Minister Abiy's recruits, and Prime Minister Abiy will really have to focus on rebounding for this, because both him and General Saara Mekonnen will be very, very difficult to replace.
Zelenom, let me ask you this. Is there something that we're missing as we report on this story? Do you believe that there's more to this story than what the Prime Minister's statement says or what we're hearing from official circles in Ethiopia?
You know, you're right. There are actually plenty of things missing. First of all, for the government to release a statement clarifying exactly what happened, it took them nearly 15 hours or so. After the initial violence, there were outages of internet service, and the Prime Minister's office remained mum on the issue and said nothing until the next day. That in itself was suspicious enough. And secondly, many people I've communicated with simply don't buy the narrative that there was a possible regional coup attempt in the Amhara region. Simply because even had the coup been successful, you would still have to deal with federal forces from Addis Ababa being deployed and taking over. Simply assassinating the president of the region and taking over several government offices is no guarantee whatsoever of gaining a stronghold of the region.
Right.
So personally, I don't think it would almost be foolhardy to attempt it. And I suggest there's more than what we are being told, but of course, to say what I believe it is would be, at this point, mere speculation.
Now, Prime Minister Ahmed, who is in his second year in office, has had to make some really pretty difficult choices as he steers the nation through some popular and sometimes difficult reforms. What does this moment mean for him and his administration as he continues to make these political and economic reforms in the country?
I think this should be a turning point for the Prime Minister, in the sense that he has made headlines over the past few months, even a year, for his shuttle diplomacy and for a lot of the work he has done in the region.
Zelenom, thank you very much. Appreciate you talking to us this morning.
No problem. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That is Zacharias Zelenom, an Ethiopian journalist and political analyst. I reached him in Montreal, Canada. The East African Legislative Assembly is expected to adopt a law to curb down corruption in the regional institutions. This comes after an audit report revealed that senior officials were involved in mismanagement of community funds of more than $1 million. For more on this story, Moses Havyarimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
The Integrity and Anti-Corruption Law is expected to be passed by the East African Legislative Assembly in efforts to promote integrity and ethical values within the organs and institutions of the East African community. Victor Burikukie is a lawmaker from Burundi.
EAC staff has no regulation with regard to anti-corruption. That is the essence of that bill. Those measures are are preventive measures and punitive measures, among them the judicial sanctions.
If the law is passed with its current form, Section 9 indicates that any person who engages in an act of corruption or corrupt practices, including diversion, mismanagement or embezzlement of financial and other resources of the community, is liable on conviction to imprisonment for a term not exceeding 10 years or to a fine not exceeding $30,000 or both. Matthias Kasamba is a lawmaker from Uganda.
This is one of the tools we are going to use to check the very high appetites at times we have in our institutions of ESC for officers who handle public resources.
Last week, an audit report revealed that top East African community officials were behind the mismanagement of the community resources of more than $1 million and can't account for 1,000 assets. Those accused included the community's secretary general and his predecessor. Julius Maganda is Uganda's East African community state minister.
There have been issues that have been raised and the members were accused. But what is most important for us as a council, we do recommendations. So we have done already our recommendations to the summit, and then they will also advise us, give us directives on how we can proceed with the disciplinary action.
However, the current East African Community Treaty, Article 73, indicates that persons employed in the services of the community shall be immune from civil process with respect to omission or acts performed by them in their official capacity. Susan Nakawuki, a lawmaker from Uganda, believes this will hinder the implementation.
So for someone who has full immunity, for example, all diplomatic passport holders, they cannot be prosecuted. When you have that immunity, unless if your diplomatic status has been lifted, you cannot be prosecuted.
According to the anti-corruption law, the national agency to which an act of corruption or corrupt practices is reported shall promptly investigate the act to establish whether the act omission reported is in contravention of the act. The court may, on the application of the National Anti-Corruption Agency, order seizure, freezing or confiscating of the property and assets. Moses Aviarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. And still in East Africa, where Ugandan officials say that they are containing the Ebola outbreak in the western Uganda district of Kasese. Since the beginning of the Ebola outbreak in the DRC in August 2018, WHO has advised neighboring countries in East Africa and the Great Lakes region to reinforce their preparedness measures. Officials said that they have stationed health workers at entry points like borders and airports to screen those entering the country in an effort to control the disease. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala, Uganda.
Emmanuel Inebiona, Uganda's Minister of Health spokesperson, says three people have died of Ebola since the first Ebola case was registered in the country about 2 weeks ago.
We continue to monitor the contacts to the first positive index cases. As you know, there are only three positive cases that were registered a week ago, and also that these three died. But now for about now 9 days, we have not registered any new positive case.
The first victim to die was a five-year-old child who traveled his family the Democratic Republic of Congo to attend a funeral of a relative, also said to have died of the deadly disease. But so far, Ainebiona says, only one person has been isolated as they wait for the laboratory results to confirm if he is having the Ebola virus. He says more than 800 people, including those that have had contact with Ebola patients, such as relatives and health workers, have been vaccinated against the Ebola virus. Ainebiona says it is important for those at risk of the disease to receive the RVSV vaccine, which has been proven to be 97% effective.
Now that they are highly at risk of exposure, at any one time, a positive case might present at one of our health facilities or at the screening point. These people have to have this vaccine to boost their immunity against the Ebola virus. And also those ones who came into contact, the vaccine can help their body to resolve an Ebola virus in case it is still being incubated.
According to the Minister of Health, at least 5,000 people have been vaccinated against the disease since 2018 as part of the preparedness following the outbreak in neighboring DR Congo. Anne Biona says although the situation is under control, people must be cautious.
We appeal to citizens to remain on high alert, mainly be vigilant, avoid things like handshaking, body contact with infected persons, and report any person who presents with signs and symptoms related to Ebola virus disease.
Ebola virus disease is hemorrhagic fever that is transmitted by direct contact with the blood, body fluids, and tissues of infected persons. The sick person presents with the signs of sudden onset fever, intense weaknesses, muscle pain, headache, and sore throat. The US government, the United Kingdom, European Union, and the Republic of Ireland are some of the governments that are funding the fight against the Ebola outbreak in the region. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR, has handed over assets worth of 2 billion Kenya shillings to the government of Kenya and the local community in Garissa. The move marks the closure of IFO2 and Cambio's refugee camps in Dadaab refugee camp complex that were degazetted in 2017. As Maureen Ojambo reports from Nairobi, Kenya, this comes at a time when the government of Kenya is set to shut down the Dadaab refugee camp by August of this year, citing insecurity.
The government of Kenya has since the year 2014 threatened the international community on the shutdown of the Dadaab refugee camp, citing insecurity from the militia group Al-Shabaab coming in as refugees and later planning attacks in the country. Speaking during the handover of facilities at the camp, UNHCR director in Kenya, Fadhia Abdallah, said that due to Kenyan call to have the camp completely shut down, they have already repatriated some refugees who wish to go back to their countries of origin.
Now, today, we're here to hand over the facilities to the government. And I think these facilities are very important. There are indications for solution, but they were there as part of solution. Because as we heard, many Somalis went back to Somalia. And therefore, those facilities and those two camps become empty. So there was a solution. And there is a hope.
The number of refugees returning home dropped last year to about 7,500 compared to 35,500 in 2017 and 34,000 in 2016. Ms. Abdallah says those refugees willing to go to Kakuma refugee camp in Turkana will be taken care of.
Relocation for those who would like to go to Kakuma, we can look into that and relocate few, probably non-Somalis, to Kakuma. The refugees told me there are a couple of things they would like us to advance on. Education. Education is very important for them. And I want to say about girls, they told me we cannot go back to Somalia because we need education, and there we do not have education.
Human rights groups criticized the renewed push to close the Dadaab, saying it threatened the rights and safety of the mostly Somali refugees who could be forced to return home. Kenya Security Permanent Secretary Patrick Ntutu said that the security of the people of Garissa has been threatened for long and that the country cannot bear that anymore.
Tuko na issues ya insecurities.
He's saying we have insecurity issues, and you all know that near to 20 years now, our neighbor Somalia will still live a bad life, and that does not mean that, like here in Garissa, anyone can get in and start problems like we had seen before. As a nation, we cannot allow. Residents living around the Dadaab refugee camp had earlier sneaked into the camp and registered as refugees when there was hunger strike in the area so as to benefit from relief foods. And now the government says it might be very difficult to be registered as Kenyans again. Kenya's principal secretary, State Department of Immigration, Border Control and Citizen Services, Gordon Kehalangwa, said that the county government of Garissa should take control of facilities being handed over by UNHCR.
To continuing to be courteous and to be able to host these refugees who have stayed here close to about 29, 30 years. And what we want to do today, and through the Chief Administrative Secretary, is to enable the county government of Garissa to take the two camps that were closed. This exercise should have taken place about 2 years ago.
Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports with Samson Omali in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Jackson. We'll begin the sports with the 32nd edition of the African Cup of Nations, which got underway on Friday in Egypt, with 24 teams participating in the tournament. After a colorful opening ceremony, host nation Egypt secured a 1-0 victory over Zimbabwe in the tournament opener at the Cairo International Stadium in Egypt. Kamal Bilyat, who was denied several scoring chances by Mohamed El Shanoui in the Egypt goalpost, says the Zimbabwe Warriors will need to work on their mistakes in their next match.
We need to work on a lot of things, but we're proud. We listened to the coach, we came back differently, and we gave it all, and we just need to rectify the little mistakes and try to shoot more.
On Saturday, three-time winners and 2013 champions Nigeria edged past tournament debutant Burundi 1-0 in Alexandria, and the latest Super Eagles coach Garrett Ross says they will continue to build on the momentum as the tournament progresses.
Yes, it was a very difficult match for us, because this team of Burundi is well organized. What's not easy is especially very difficult to score the first goal. If the first goal is not coming quickly, you suffer and have to work hard to score and to win the matches.
Meanwhile, Madagascar marked their first appearance with a point against Guinea. The match ended 2-2, and elsewhere, Uganda recorded their first victory in 41 years at the tournament after overcoming DR Congo 2-0. Tournament favourites Senegal got their 2019 African Cup of Nations campaign off to the perfect start with a 2-0 win over Tanzania at the 30th June Stadium in Cairo on Sunday evening. And it was heartbreaking for Namibia, as Namibian Itamunwa Kimuni headed an 89th-minute Hakim Ziyech free kick into his own net to gift Morocco a 1-0 victory on Sunday in the opening African Cup of Nations Group D match. Moroccan player Mbarak Bosufa described their game against the Namibians as a very difficult match.
Very hard game, I think, but I think we dominated the game. We tried to score, but it was not easy. With Namibia, who is very defensive.
Manchester City star Riyad Mahrez scored as an untroubled Algeria cruised to a 2-0 victory over African Cup of Nations underdogs Kenya in their first game of the competition on Sunday. And in an unprecedented move, the Democratic Republic of Congo squad have apologized to their compatriots for unexpectedly losing their opening game of the African Cup of Nations to underrated Uganda on Saturday. A total of 13 goals have been scored after day 3 of competition at the 2019 African Cup of Nations Championship in Egypt. In today's game, Cote d'Ivoire will face South Africa, while Tunisia will confront Angola. The last fixture of the day will see Mali confronting Mauritania. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, June the 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good week ahead.
This weekend, put this on your to-do list. Have fun. Listen to Music Time in Africa. I'm Heather Maxwell. Join me this Sunday for 55 minutes of the best commercial-free Pan-African music on earth. You'll hear dancehall, jalia, new hipco, afro beats, Sahelian live band, and more. Song of the Week features Kiz Daniel's new ode to Lagos. And Soulja Love's got a dancehall tune that's firing up the Zimbabwe Warriors for the Africa World Cup. You'll also meet reporter Samed Gaida, who brings a special deep dive report from Tamale, Ghana, about music in Dagbon.
Thank you, Hector Maxwell.
So, to do? Listen to Music Time in Africa, 1505 or 20500 Universal Time.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.